All right, our last case this morning is 2015-543, in re the application of John David Tynes. For the applicant, Mr. Johnson.
Chief Justice O'Connor, may it please the court, I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. Perhaps the most important attribute of a lawyer is honesty. Honesty is what engenders the trust of clients, adversaries, courts, and others, which is required by GovBar Rule 1, Section 11, D3. John David Tynes was arrested in 1998, and the record reflects that he was immediately honest with the FBI about his conduct and even volunteered other evidence to them that he had in his house and surrendered that. He, at that time, was an Army officer with 20 years of service to the country. He had top secret clearance. In his court-martial proceeding, he did not avail himself of his Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination, but rather testified completely about his transgressions. He served 19 months in the brig. He was released and ultimately was honorably discharged. He then tried to get work and moved with his family a couple of times around the country because he was registered as a sex offender. He engaged in a website called Prison Talk, which was a support website for prisoners and their families. And he developed the belief that this was a population of people that was underserved, people who didn't have money in the prison system and their families needed legal representation. In 2010, about 12 years after this arrest, he applied to 20 law schools and was accepted at one, Chase in Northern Kentucky. He made a full disclosure of his conduct on his application to law school. There is a character letter in evidence from the then dean of that law school that said, in light of his transgressions, they decided to accept him and that they were pleased that they had on his graduation, and the dean recommended that he would be a productive member of the profession. When he graduated, he obviously had trouble with admissions because of the nature of his previous crime and conviction. He has been reviewed by a forensic psychiatrist. He was completely honest with the psychiatrist. The psychiatrist finds no impediment to his practicing law in an ethical manner. He engaged in periodic, weekly, and biweekly counseling with a psychologist who reports the same complete honesty and no hesitancy recommending him for admission to the bar. He has signed an OLAP contract, and Scott Moat has no objection to his taking the bar.
Counsel, where is he on the OLAP contract?
I think he's
in the midst of it, correct?
He is.
Okay, and when does that conclude?
At the time of the hearing, he was about a year and a half into it, so he probably has another 3 years now.
Okay, thank you.
And this proactive activity that you just described was all done after his application?
That's true. He immediately after his release from prison, he got some pastoral counseling from his church that he said was helpful. But he has admitted that the counseling that he's gotten from the psychiatrist and the psychologist has been very helpful to him.
But it was done after he was struggling to get admitted, correct?
Well, it was after he started the admission
after
process.
Law school.
That's true.
And in preparation for admission to take a bar.
Right. He had an interview with the Cincinnati Bar Association, and they said, you know, you haven't had any counseling.
Right. Why Ohio for his state of choice?
Well, he doesn't have to register as a sex offender in the state of Ohio.
Is there any other jurisdiction where he would have to register?
I don't know the answer to that. Where he would have to register, there are others where he would have to register. I don't know if there are others where he would not have to register. But Chase Law School was the one school that he got into. And so I think
would he have to register in Kentucky?
If he lived or practiced in Kentucky, probably yes.
Yes. Okay.
The board got hung up on Section D5, the fourth subsection, which is the public's perception of the profession being impacted by the admission of this man.
Well, counsel, I'm reading that right now, and I want to know, you've done a lot more research on this case than I have. The board is saying allowing a convicted sex offender to hold a position of trust would clearly undermine the public's perception of and confidence in the legal profession. Have we as the Supreme Court ever said that? that if you are a sex offender, you may not be a lawyer?
No, and there are five cases. The most recent is ODC versus Grossman, which came out in the Green Book last week, where this court has said about practicing lawyers who have committed similar offenses, you're indefinitely suspended and eligible to come back. Obviously, if that was an insurmountable bar, those lawyers would have been disbarred. And I think that it, as in all public conversation, the opinion rests on the knowledge of the facts. And I think if the public knew the details of this man's service, the way he's conducted himself since, the fact that professionals have no concern about recidivism, his desire to be a lawyer at his relatively late stage in life to help people who can't afford lawyers, that his admission to the profession would be a compliment to the profession, because we have taken seriously the fact that this man has paid his debt to society. He's been evaluated and doesn't pose a current threat, and he's welcome to come in and prove himself if he can pass the bar and engage in the ethical practice of law.
Have we had other situations where we have agreed to the admission of individuals who have committed other felonies, let's say 17 years before?
Yes, there are a couple of other cases.
And what were the nature of those felonies?
One of the felonies was breaking and entering. One of the offenses was the applicant had shot a jogger with a BB gun. That's the Begain case that's cited in our brief. And that case is really interesting because this court's opinion reflects that the applicant had not been truthful in his statements to the Michigan bar or the Ohio bar, and yet he was allowed to sit for the bar. And so I go back to my original statements about honesty, which is the benchmark of any lawyer. If you're not honest, you don't have any other attributes that would make you worthy of practicing law. Tynes has committed an offense which is horribly embarrassing, and he testified to that at the hearing. What he did is not explainable.
What about the fact that, you know, the label sex offender, the stigma, the public stigma that is, you know, that happens, and the umbrella is very wide and encompasses a number of offenses that may not be what would be considered violent? Your client would be in that category, correct?
He's not violent, correct.
Not violent. So, you know, the idea, though, that the term sex offender in the public perception may have an entirely different point of view, is that where the Bar Association is coming from, that because of that stigma, we should not ever allow an applicant who has that in the past to become a lawyer?
I'll let Mr. McCartney address that, but that's my understanding. And again, it's the depth of the knowledge that's important. If we attach a label, a single label, sex offender, and you took a poll of the public and said sex offender lawyer, the public would generally say no. But you can do that with almost any single word description of a human being. And as I said, the important thing in this case is the fact that this was an isolated incident, and all of the other positive things that he's done in his life and the way he's owned this problem.
Well, the word comes to my mind is thief.
Thief.
Using your example, if you put the word thief and lawyer together, people would be repulsed by the thought.
Absolutely.
But obviously, there's many lawyers who have misappropriated funds.
Yes.
That are practicing law today.
True. Thank you.
You indicated we had some other case where we just did an indefinite instead of a disbar. Did that involve underage?
Yes, there are five cases,
girls.
and they're very similar. They involve trying to set up meetings with underage, with who the lawyer thought was an underage person, and they involve child pornography. Four of them are cited in the brief, and the most recent is the Grossman case.
There's a difference, I think, between looking at child pornography on one's computer and setting up a meeting where one wants to engage in sexual conduct with an underage child.
That's true.
And we have...
You've had cases where the lawyer attempted to set up a meeting with who he thought was an underage adult, an underage human.
Should there be any difference in the way we look at someone who wants to be admitted and has never been admitted in the state versus someone who has been engaged in the practice as otherwise well-served clients. And the question is, do we give them the death penalty or do we allow them the opportunity to come back and petition the court for reentry at some point?
I think there are strong policy reasons to look at the record of a lawyer and say he or she has conducted themselves appropriately for X number of years before this transgression. But what's unusual about this case is this isn't a 26-year-old kid who's come to try and take the bar and has this in his past. He was 50 years old at the time of this crime. So there's a long window. You have the ability to look at his life and see that, as I said, he served his country, he had top secret clearance, he had no prior transgressions, he was married, he's still married to the same woman, he's got four kids, he was an active member in his church. So there is a body of conduct that you can look at, much like you can look at the conduct of a lawyer. If he was a 26 or 27-year-old applicant, you could say, you know, he hasn't really had a chance to make mistakes, and I'm looking at this 40-year-old lawyer who's practiced for 14 years, and I have more of a feeling of who he or she is. Okay. But here you've got that evidence.
What did the psychologist, forensic psychologist Dr. Smalden, meet when he said the applicant is someone who marches to his own drummer?
I think he also says in the report that he's opinionated, and if you know, you won't be in a conversation with him long without understanding what he thinks. He was in military intelligence. He's a strong-minded guy. He knows what he thinks, and he does what he thinks is right, and with this one exception. And he'll tell you what he thinks is right.
Well, I mean, back then, well, even during the hearing, he said there were some mitigating circumstances here. He was having trouble with his wife, and the kids were unruly, and so, of course, he went to attempting to have sex with underage girls.
Yeah, not a very convincing excuse.
No.
The psychiatrist and the psychologist both say a couple of things: midlife crisis, feeling of isolation, partially because of his job, some sexual issues, and this was, at the kind of birth of the internet, and it was unusual, it was new, it was a fantasy for him, it was something outside his normal experience.
Well, it was more than a fantasy. He actually diverted a business trip to go to Chicago to, you know, try and engage in a hotel tryst with a 13-year-old, I think.
A 13 or 14, right? It was, yeah. And it's.
So, I mean, but for the fact, thank goodness, that it was a sting operation and not a real little girl, these are the components of sex trafficking. If we don't have these type of men out there, we wouldn't have the sex trafficking problem that we have in this country.
I understand.
And here he was at the genesis of it. What you're saying is, you know, the new computer age, and rather than buying a red sports car for midlife crisis, he decides to engage in this type of activity.
Well, and if he had actually met with an underage woman and engaged in an act of pedophilia, we would have a different case. But those aren't the facts
of
this case.
So he should benefit from the fact that it was a sting and not a real encounter?
Well, you know, one always has the opportunity. It's not a foregone conclusion. You could get to a meeting with a 14-year-old girl and remember what your daughter, one of your three daughters, looks like at the time.
And was that his testimony that I really don't even think I could have gone through with it? I didn't read anything to that effect.
He certainly said that with regard to the person that he was allegedly attempting to see in Louisville. He said, I wouldn't have gone through with it. I know I wouldn't have. It's not an easy case. I'm not excusing his conduct, but I'm saying it was 17 years ago and there isn't another blemish. And he wants to do something besides make money with his law license. He wants to help people who can't afford a lawyer.
And how old is he now?
I believe he's 65. I have just about 30 seconds left. I'd like to save that for rebuttal if there are no other questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. McCurtney.
Thank you. Chief Justice O'Connor, may please the court. I am Paul McCarty here on behalf of the Cincinnati Bar Association. This is an unusual case in the sense that there really is no dispute as to the facts. They're pretty much in agreement on the facts. There's really not much dispute as to the law. There is no bright line rule in Ohio first off, that a felony in and of itself will prevent you from being admitted and being able to take the bar.
Counsel, you will agree with me, though, that if we were to affirm this case, there will be a bright line law in Ohio. Sex offenders shall never practice law in Ohio.
That is one way that you could go about affirming this case, but it's not the only way. It could also be based on the specific facts of this case. In fact, the Cincinnati Bar Association did not reach and did not recommend that he never be allowed to sit for the bar. They just denied his application to sit for the bar. And excuse me, I don't remember the precise year. This has been going on several years now, for the next bar examination, knowing full well that automatically would send it up to the Board of Commissioners on Character and Fitness. So that was not the concern that the Cincinnati Bar Association had, trying to create a bright line rule that because of the sexual nature of his felonies, he should forever be precluded from sitting. If this court wants to adopt that rule, it certainly could have in other cases, such as the cases Mr. Johnson referenced, dealing with lawyers who have run into trouble. It also could, through the rules of government of the bar, adopt the rule, but instead, under Rule 1, Section 11, that is not the rule for felonies, and this court easily could adopt such a rule that any kind of sexual offense that would require, like, registration on a sexual registry would be an automatic bar. What we looked at, and I think on the facts of this case, that Mr. Tynes has not shown by clear and convincing evidence that he has the requisite moral character to sit for the bar examination and become a lawyer.
So the offense was 17 years ago, and
yes.
You're saying that's insufficient time to look at a record to see if he has sufficient moral character? And based on what we've heard with respect to the things that he's done, that's insufficient?
I'm not saying that 17 years is insufficient in all cases. I'm saying 17 years in this case, along with the other factors, mean that he does not or has not proven by clear and convincing evidence that he should be allowed to sit for the bar.
So now, upon realizing he's having a difficulty sitting with the bar, he is engaged in what probably would have been proper activity had he thought about doing it when he entered law school, and that would be the OLAP contract and counseling and that sort of thing.
Not only when he entered law school, but going back to shortly after his release from prison, it would have been good activity for him to engage in and get some counseling as to deal with why this occurred in a 50-year-old man. And what's disturbing to me, and I think Chief Justice O'Connor, you touched on it was after the process was in place and after the first hearing with the Cincinnati Bar Association, because there were actually two hearings, when he decided that he was going to enter into the OLAP contract. And it wasn't, even though he saw the forensic psychiatrist in February of 2013, he didn't actually get to signing his contract with OLAP and beginning the counseling until September of 2013.
So he has a 5-year contract with OLAP?
Yes.
And based on what you said just a short time ago, you're not saying never sit for the bar exam. It's let's get further down the road and do an evaluation with, after there's some significant time spent with compliance with OLAP and the continuing mental health treatments that he's engaged in.
The Cincinnati Bar Association and their admissions committee did not say never sit for the bar. That was the Board of Commissioners on Character and Fitness. I do think there is sufficient evidence here, if this court desired, they could say never sit for the bar. However, even if the court decides we're not going to create, the facts in this case do not warrant never sitting for the bar, and do not want to create a bright line rule that someone with a sexual offense like this cannot sit for the bar, that he still hasn't proven that he possesses the requisite moral character to sit presently. And I base that in part on his age at the time, even though 17 years has passed, he was 50 years old. And the two cases that Mr. Johnson cited in his client's brief both dealt with people who had committed felonies when they were only 19 years old. And the one who has a reported case where he ultimately was allowed to sit for the bar, it was 11 years later before he was allowed to sit for the bar.
Counsel, I want to make sure it's clear because this is a troubling case and it's hard, and your bar association, I think, has put a lot of work into this.
Yes, Your Honor.
Are you now advocating against the finding of the board? Because the board clearly said in their final sentence that he not be permitted to apply for the Ohio bar examination in the future. Now, for a 65-year-old person, that's never.
Your Honor, I am not I am not backing away from the board's decision. I am saying I don't believe that there is a bright-line rule. This court has not adopted a bright-line rule in the handling of cases.
That's the nice thing about you coming to the Supreme Court of Ohio today. What bright-line rule are you advocating?
I am not advocating any bright-line rule. I am advocating that in this particular case, with these particular facts, Mr. Tynes should not be allowed to sit for the bar in Ohio ever. Based on his age when he committed the indiscretion, the fact that the years went by without him getting the counseling, and only when it was obvious that he was going to experience significant difficulty in getting through the admissions process. And also, I don't want to go so far as to say lack of candor, but lack of recognition and acceptance of his actions and taking full responsibility for his actions. And I mentioned it in the brief in the two instances of when he talked about the what he thought was a young girl, at least in Louisville, we don't know if that was a trap or not. And he said, I would never have gone through with it. But yet, afterwards, he made a trip to Alabama, to Birmingham, Alabama, to try to
300 miles out of his way.
300 miles out of his way, and arranged a layover on his way to Las Vegas to stop in Chicago. And he also tried to minimize the issue as to the Alabama stop over and saying, well, that was a sting anyway. Giving, sort of saying, hey, because it was a sting, it doesn't really count. And as Chief Justice O'Connor sort of touched on, that but for this being a sting operation in Chicago, it is likely he would have gone forward. It is likely this might not have been the last time.
Counsel, so, he's out of law school now, right?
He's out of law school.
And where does he live? Does he live in Ohio or does he live in some other state?
He lives in Ohio.
Right. And what is he doing?
I don't know what his employment status is currently.
Does he have I assume some military pension or not?
He does. He was honorably discharged from the military with full pension.
All right. And as to, you can use your law degree in a lot of other ways other than representing clients in court. You can even work for agencies that provide a whole set of social services, helping with housing, those kinds of things without actually practicing, can you not?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
But we don't know what he's doing.
We do not know what he's doing presently. The record.
Perhaps his attorney.
His attorney would probably know. I think the record is silent on what his present activities are, even as of the hearing on January 27th of 2015. So I think that we do not know what he's doing currently. But beyond that, there were other ways he could have gone about helping people that did not involve going into the practice of law. He took a risk in making the decision to go into the practice of law. His testimony on that was he applied to 20 different law schools, was in fact first rejected by Northern Kentucky Chase, but then was on a second try, was admitted. And part of what led to his decision to apply to Chase was because he had called and spoke to someone at the Supreme Court who said it was not an absolute bar for him to be admitted to Ohio based on his prior felony conviction.
We did admit, perhaps the one that was the most controversial was Farmer, wasn't it?
I remember that well, Your Honor.
Yeah, I'll bet you do. Because that came from Cincinnati, too, did it?
Yes, Your Honor.
And we changed the process after that case, did we not?
Yes, you did, Your Honor.
Right.
And that gets down to the public perception. You could see that the public backlash and outcry about Derek Farmer, who was convicted of killing a police officer, having him practice as a lawyer. And I am not suggesting that everybody, because there are situations where I can see that someone commits a crime, a sexual crime, at a certain age in a certain situation where it should not be an absolute bar. This is not the case because of the other factors to which I have alluded. And I think the public outcry is going to be terrible if it comes out that someone who has committed convicted of a sexual crime such as his crime was allowed to sit and practice as a lawyer. And yes, there are two of the cases to which Mr. Johnson cites dealing with lawyers involved actual conduct or attempt at contact, the disciplinary counsel versus Goldblatt, and I'm going to butcher the last name here, disciplinary counsel versus Pansiera, where there was sexual conduct or contact by an adult with a teen that he met through AA. But there are differences, and I think some deference given to someone who's been practicing a lawyer versus someone who is coming in and trying to be admitted for the first time. So it is our belief, based on these facts, that Mr. Tyne should be denied the opportunity to ever sit for the bar. And if the court disagrees with that decision, at least I think following along the lines of the discipline that's been meted out to those practicing lawyers, that he should be given what it would be equivalent to an indefinite suspension and at least have 2 years to get further into the OLAP program and to see how he's doing and how he's doing with the counseling before this court allows him to sit for the bar. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Johnson.
The question of the timing of the counseling is an interesting question, because when he had the evaluation by the psychiatrist, he didn't need any remedial work. The psychiatrist said that he would benefit from some periodic counseling, and he has in fact continued the counseling beyond the point in time when the psychologist thought it was necessary. The last point I'd like to make is that David Singleton, who's the director of the Ohio Justice and Policy Center and a professor at Northern Kentucky University, taught this man classes and worked with him as an intern. He used his intern's license to defend indigent clients. And he wrote a glowing letter of recommendation and actually came to answer questions at the hearing. So from the people that know him, the woman in his study group, Stacy Ellison, from the dean of the law school, from Professor Singleton, he's gotten recommendations.
What is he doing now, if you know?
I'm sorry?
What is he doing now, if you know?
I don't know what he's doing today. I know that recently he is fluent in Spanish, and he's been volunteering, helping Spanish speakers that have trouble navigating life where they don't speak the native tongue with a volunteer organization.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you. We'll take the matter under advisement, and you'll be notified of our decision. Marshall, will you adjourn court, please?
All rise. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. This open session of the Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio now stands adjourned.